This is Wide Margins, episode 13, King of Thorns. In the last episode, we talked about Gideon, his life and times, and the challenge that was presented to him to become king. And Gideon refused, at least on the it appeared on the surface that he refused to be king. He said, "I won't become your king, my sons won't become the king, the Lord will rule over you." He said that, but immediately afterwards, he began acting just like a king. So if he wasn't a king in name, he was, practically speaking, a king in every other sense, which created a big problem, and we talked about that last episode. What's interesting is, as we come to these glimpses of the monarchy that would eventually become a full-fledged monarchy in the book of 1 Samuel, we reflect on the law of Moses, how Moses anticipated this, even though it wasn't God's ideal. God did not set up a monarchy in his law. He prohibited it, but he also regulated it, knowing that his flawed people would go against his will. God had established in Moses what is known as a theocratic government. That's a government centered upon God, and the rulers would acknowledge that God was actually the head of the country. But a monarchy would put the king at the head of the country, and as we talked about last episode, a king who was transparent to God would still rule well and successfully, but so often kings did not fulfill their God-given mandate and would make everything about themselves, center the government on themselves. Moses, as I said, regulated the monarchy in the law of Moses, and it's interesting to compare what he said in the law to the behavior of Gideon. For example, in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 17, this is what Moses wrote of the king. "He shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold." Well, Gideon did acquire many wives for himself, and he did hoard up excessive gold. He even constructed of that gold an ephod, which became a snare for the house of Gideon. Gideon did not follow the regulations given in the law of Moses for a ruler of God's people. Now, Gideon had 70 sons with this harem of wives, and he also had concubines, at least one in Shechem, a concubine who bore him a son who was given the name Abimelech. Abimelech means, "My father is king," yet another indication that while Gideon said he would not rule over Israel as a king, he believed in his heart, or he wanted in his heart, to have that kind of a dynasty. Abimelech, "My father is king." This Abimelech became a ruthless renegade that was a stain on the history of Israel. He tried to set himself up as a king. Unlike his father, he did not deny it. He wanted to be king. He even established some kind of a rule from his home in Shechem. And if you compare Gideon to the law of Moses in Deuteronomy 17:17, it's also interesting to compare Abimelech to the rest of what is said in Deuteronomy 17. Here's how it picks up in verse 18. "And when this king sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel." So Moses sees this king who will even copy down for himself in his own hand the law of Moses and live by it and do it every single day. Not only that, he won't be an arrogant, conceited, power-hungry king, but one who rules in humility and self-sacrifice, not above his brothers. I'm sure Israel many times longed for a king like that. I'm not sure they ever got one, but Abimelech certainly was not that king. Abimelech wasn't the official first king of Israel. That title belongs to Saul, but he was the first to openly desire a monarchy, to rule as a king. And he achieved some success in that, for we read in Judges 9 that he ruled over Israel for 3 years. Now here's an interesting thought. This is an original thought with me. I heard somebody talk about it some time ago when he was talking about Abimelech, and he said, the book of Judges covers something like 350 years. That's longer than the time period our nation has been in existence. We haven't been around 350 years. And yet, these 3 years were preserved by inspiration for us to know about and to learn and to study. We hardly ever talk about Abimelech, but the Lord said, out of 350 years, I'm going to let these 3 years stand out in a whole chapter in this book. If you had to pick 3 years of our nation's history to put down in a book, to give a whole chapter to in a book of only 21 chapters, which 3 years would you select? There are certainly some pivotal moments in our country, but a 3-year time period, there are only a few of those that are worthy to be preserved in the history books. So there must be something important about Abimelech. We shouldn't overlook it, and I'll admit, it's been a challenge to me to find what's relevant here, but it has to have something to do with the King of Thorns, his being a king and his being compared to thorns. So we're going to look at Abimelech this way and see one of the darkest hours of Israel's history. Now, Abimelech is going to be presented to us in 3 different ways in Judges chapter 9, each one worse than the one before. First, you'll see him as a rose, you know, something beautiful, something great, a leader that his people can count upon, or at least some of the people. But then you see him as a thorn, and then finally you see him as fire. But let's start with the rose, which takes us to the beginning of Judges chapter 9. You'll remember that Abimelech's mother was from Shechem. Shechem is a place with a dubious history in the minds of the Israelites. In some ways it was good, and in other ways it was bad. It was the first place Abraham camped when he came into Canaan, which eventually became Israel's inheritance. And it was also where Joseph was buried. In verse 6 of Judges chapter 9, there's this oak that's mentioned at Shechem, and this may have been a very important tree, kind of a holy place that the Israelites would visit, because it may have been the tree where Jacob rededicated his life and did away with his idols in Genesis chapter 38. And more recent to today's narrative, it's where Joshua made that famous stand where he said, "Choose this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." So Shechem was an important place, but it wasn't quite an Israelite place. And there were some ugly stains on Shechem's history. It had a checkered past. Probably the worst event occurred in Genesis chapter 34, where the prince of Shechem raped the only daughter of Jacob, the sister of the 12 sons of Jacob, a woman named Dinah. And afterwards, I think it was Levi and Simeon slaughtered the village in which all of this occurred in Shechem. That was still in the minds of the Israelites by the days of the judges. But then also you can see that the people of Shechem didn't identify with Israel as much as it seems at the beginning of this chapter. Later on, after Abimelech gets control of Israel, including Shechem, there's a man of Shechem named Gaal who rebels against Abimelech, and his argument is Abimelech is a son of Gideon, and Gideon is not one of our own. He says, "Who is Abimelech, and who are we of Shechem, that we should serve him?" So you can see there was some kind of a distinction, whatever it was. To us, it may not seem like much, but evidently to them, it seemed like a big deal. So this is Shechem, where all of this is taking place. It was Abimelech's home in many ways. He was split between Gideon, his father's household, and his mother's household in Shechem. And he goes back to his mother's household, and he starts with his relatives there. And he makes a couple of arguments to them in favor of his becoming king in the place of his father, who has just passed away. Verse 2 has these. And the first one is, which is better for you, that all 70 sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one rule over you? Jerubbaal, I'll remind you, is the other name for Gideon. It means he strives with Baal. And it goes all the way back to when Gideon tore down the idols of his father's household. So what's better? The first argument goes, would you like to be ruled by 70 sons or just one? Maybe this is the meaning behind that argument. Maybe Abimelech is saying, I'm the only illegitimate son of Gideon. These other 70 guys are equals to each other. So you either get one or you get 70. Now what's better, to have 70 kings all pulling you in different directions, or to have one king who may not always agree with you, but at least you know where he stands? His second argument to the people of Shechem, though, is stronger, at least in their minds, because he says, remember also, I am your bone and your flesh. I'm one of you. You could have one of your own family members on the throne, on the first throne in many ways, in the nation of Israel. Now, when is this going to happen again? This is an opportunity of a lifetime. You cannot turn this down. So his relatives get behind him, and they get the village of Shechem behind them, and they all go and raid the temple of Baal-berith for 70 pieces of silver to fund Abimelech's campaign, if you want to look at it that way. Now, you know politics. You know how it goes. If you want to know the character of somebody, sometimes you look at his donors. Where is he getting his money? We do this in America, although we might not pay as much attention to it as we should, but it's good political fodder anyway for one candidate to criticize where the other candidate's getting his money. The money tells you a little bit about who has influence over him. So now Abimelech has accepted this money from an idol temple and from idolaters, which ought to tell you that he really doesn't care about the God of Israel or about upholding the law. And the king of Israel, according to the law of Moses, if there is one, is supposed to copy down his own copy of the law and know it by heart and read from it regularly. He clearly doesn't care anything about this. He's getting started off on the wrong foot. He looks like a rose, but as we're going to see, there are thorns on this rose. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me develop this a little bit more. So they fund him with these 70 pieces of silver, and he goes out and hires what the writer of the book of Judges call worthless and reckless fellows. Bad dudes, bad hombres. And he gathers them together, gets this army of them together, and what he wants them to do is round up his 70 brothers. Now, there were a lot of different mothers involved. All of these were half-brothers, but still, they were his blood, and they were innocent. They were rivals to the throne, but they were innocent. He had them rounded up, and it says that he killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men, on one stone. I know that's a little puzzling. You think, was he standing on a stone and they were attacking him and he was slaughtering them in battle? That's not what it means. It was more cowardly than that. This was a public execution where he personally slayed each one of them as they were led to him bound hand and foot, maybe put on top of the stone, or maybe their head was put on the stone, and he killed them with his sword one by one. And so cowardly, because it wasn't a fair fight, it's so vicious and it's so public, you really start to see beneath the petals, if you will, of this rose, and you're seeing this is really not something pretty at all. So he rounds up his brothers, publicly executes them, but one gets away, a brother named Jotham. And Jotham is the one that really shows the true colors of Abimelech. He's not a rose. He's a thorn. Jotham goes to this special place in the area of Shechem called Mount Gerizim. Now, if you're a New Testament student, you probably know Mount Gerizim as the place where the Samaritan woman talked about worshiping. The Samaritans, between the time of the Old and New Testaments, actually constructed a temple on Mount Gerizim. It was torn down by the time of Jesus. But in these days, it was better known as one of the two hilltops around Shechem mentioned by Moses in Deuteronomy chapters 27 and 28. Moses said, "When you come into the land you are to possess, you're to go to Shechem and declare the blessings of the law from Mount Gerizim and the curses of the law from Mount Ebal," which is another hilltop in that area of Shechem. Now, Jotham, he ascends Mount Gerizim, which is symbolic that he is about to speak the blessings of the Lord. But what he says actually sounds more like a curse. You decide for yourself. And the way that he delivers it is really interesting. He delivers it in the form of this little story, or maybe you should call it a fable, about different kinds of trees who are being asked to be king. Here's how it goes. This is Judges chapter 9, beginning in verse 8. "The trees once went out to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my abundance by which gods and men are honored and go to hold sway over the trees?' And the trees said to the fig tree, 'You come and reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go to hold sway over the trees?' And the tree said to the vine, 'You come and reign over us.' But the vine said to them, 'Shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go to hold sway over the trees?' Then all the trees said to the bramble, 'You come and reign over us.' And the bramble said to the trees, 'If in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon.'" It's kind of an interesting fable. What does it mean? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But I want to point out one thing just about monarchy, rulers, leaders in general. Keep in mind, some scholars shy away from this idea because it seems a little out of context, but it seems to frown upon the whole idea of monarchy in general because it was subject to corruption. You know God's feelings on the matter. Ideally, he never wanted Israel to have a king. He did regulate the monarchy in the law, as we read at the top of this episode. And in 1 Samuel chapter 8, when they eventually establish for the rest of their history a monarchy, at least until the fall of Babylon, the Lord was steadfastly against the monarchy. He told Samuel, "They haven't rejected you, they've rejected me as king over them." So God was against this, and I don't think I'm reading too much into it to see some cynicism towards the monarchy. Here you have the brightest and the best of Israel being approached for kingship, and they're saying, "No thanks, I've got better things to do." And the only one who's willing is the useless bramble or thorn. He says, "If nobody else wants this, why, I could do it. You could rest under my shade." Now, brambles are bushes full of thorns, not good shade trees. They're not even trees. I look into this and I can't help but think about a complaint I hear in America every election season. People say, "Why can't we find better candidates for the president? Why aren't all of these successful CEOs and academics and inventors and brilliant people, leaders in communities, why aren't they running for president?" And the answer is, they're too smart to run for president. They don't want that kind of life for themselves or for their family. It would be, for them, a financial sacrifice. They would sacrifice their privacy. They would sacrifice their peace, their freedom. It's a great sacrifice to sit in that public office, the Oval Office. On the other hand, so many times it seems that the wrong kind of people get into office. I don't want to get too political here. I think you can follow what I'm saying. Just look at the track record, and you can see that oftentimes we settle for less because the only people who want to go through something like a campaign or an election are people who will resort to things that higher-minded people just won't do. Unethical things, many times. Maybe I'm reading too much into this fable, but I see a hint of that here. When you have the best and the brightest of the trees, these grand olive trees and fig trees, grapevines saying, "No thanks, I've got better things to do, more productive, more beautiful, more artful. I've got these things to do. I can't stoop or condescend to something like king over the trees." And the one who wants the job is the thorn. And the thorn, Jotham is saying, the thorn is Abimelech. You are choosing a thorn to rule over you. Thorns have a long history in the Bible. They're used in all kinds of ways. And I think, to me, the primary point of reference for a thorn is Genesis chapter 3, verse 18. This is after Adam and Eve sinned, they're being cast out of the Garden of Eden, and they're being cursed. And part of the curse is on the earth. All the created order falls under this curse. This is why there's death and sickness in the world. This is why thorns come up out of the ground instead of just good fruit and things for people to eat, green grass and such. In Genesis 3:17, the Lord says, "Cursed is the earth because of you." And in verse 18, he says, "Thorns and thistles it will bring forth." That's the first mention of thorns. And I think it's the primary point of reference for thorns and the imagery of thorns in the Bible. Everything looks back to that. If you see how the thorns are used later, you see reflections of that. There are many references to thorns as signs of entropy in the Proverbs and in the book of Isaiah. In other words, if you just leave the earth alone, it's not going to get better, it's going to get worse. It's going to turn to thorns. Sluggards are told that their land, their property, their farms are going to thorns. The inhabitants of Canaan in Numbers 33:55 are referred to as thorns in the sides and burrs in the eyes of the Israelites. If you don't drive them out, they're going to be a thorn to you, not a good thing, a curse. And that is repeated later on near the end of Joshua and even in the book of Judges in chapter 2, verse 3. And then you have all of these references to fire, because if you think about it, there's not much use for a thorn bush aside from fuel. It will burn, and it will burn in a sign of judgment. You see that throughout so many prophetic and poetical references in the Old Testament. And that's exactly what Abimelech becomes. He's a thorn in the side of the Israelites, a snare for them, and he is going to end in fire, and it's not going to help anybody, not himself, not the people of Shechem, nor the people of Israel. As we turn to the third image of Abimelech as this fire, we see a particular kind of fire, not a warming fire, not a fire that is used for cooking or some other kind of a tool, not a fire that provides light or life in any way, but a fire that is all-consuming. It is a black hole of fire that swallows up everything. And this was due to Jotham's prediction. He says in verse 20, "Let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the leaders of Shechem, and let fire come out from the leaders of Shechem and devour Abimelech." It's a fire that turns on itself. Shechem will consume Abimelech. Abimelech will consume Shechem. And this is how the story ends as well. I'm not going to get into the battle and all the details of it, but the people of Shechem finally get tired of Abimelech. There's a rebel named Gaal who decides to lead the revolt. He does so unsuccessfully. Abimelech puts them down. He even runs the remaining people of Shechem into a tower, the Tower of Shechem, where they go as a stronghold, and he sets it on fire. So he is literally using fire, and it consumes something like 1,000 men and women who are just running for shelter. They were just trying to hide. Abimelech is becoming more and more ruthless. And he tries this again in another city, Thebes, I think is the way that it's pronounced. And the people all run up into the tower there. And he starts to gather up kindling and things to set that tower on fire. It worked in Shechem. It should work in Thebes. But what he doesn't anticipate is that there is an older woman at the top of the tower. And for some reason, she has carried with her all the way to the top of that tower a millstone, or maybe there was one up there already, that's more likely. And she sees her opportunity as Abimelech is down there with his Bic lighter trying to light the fire. And so she shoves the millstone out of the window, and it falls and cracks him in the head. And he says to one of his servants there, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that it will not be said of Abimelech that he was killed by a woman." Do you see the recurring theme here in Judges? This takes us back to Judges chapters 4 and 5, when Sisera runs to the tent of Jael and thinks that he's in a safe place, and she drives a tent peg through his head, and Deborah taunts him, saying that he was overthrown by a woman. Deborah tells Barak, "You will not be the instrument of God's wrath or the instrument of God's salvation, but a woman will deliver the people." And here again we see this one more time in Judges on behalf of God's people. You could add Delilah in the story of Samson later on as yet another woman, although she's an anti-hero, she's not a hero. She's against God's people, not working in their favor. I don't know what this is saying about women. I know women were marginalized in those days, and God did not draw that distinction because he's lifting them up alongside men as heroes in his movement. You have Deborah, you have Jael, you have this certain woman, an unnamed woman, who are just as powerful as the men. And all of it may be there to show, as we said back in the episode on Deborah, that the people weren't behind this at all, that God was in control the whole time. In fact, as the theme of the all-consuming fire continues, we read at the end of the book that God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. See, God is the subject of that sentence. He's the one that has been in control. He is the one who started the fire and put the fire out. This attempt that Abimelech was using to use evil to rule didn't work then, and it doesn't work now. And that's behind Paul's advice in Romans chapter 12 to people who are being persecuted and wronged in whatever way, who are suffering injustices. He doesn't say just live with injustice and be happy with injustice. You ought to just be satisfied with that. That's the way things are. He says, leave the vengeance business to God. Vengeance is mine. I will repay. And at the end of the chapter, Romans chapter 12, Paul says, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. If you try to fight evil with evil, and you get into the revenge business, and you fight fire with fire, as Abimelech did, you're going to be overcome by it. It is an all-consuming fire, revenge is. But if you try to return good for evil, then you can overcome it. And that's an important theme here as we look at Abimelech and see what happened to him. It can happen to us as well. The King of Thorns burned out, was no more. And as we continue in Judges, it will be as if he had never existed. There was another King of Thorns after Abimelech, a very different King of Thorns, Abimelech used thorns to crush his own people, but this second king of thorns was crushed with the thorns of the people. Abimelech was cursed and returned the curse upon himself. But the second king of thorns, while also cursed, ended the curse with a sacrifice of himself, so that there would be no more thorns, never again. Abimelech was a terrible king of thorns. But the next king of thorns was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, who bore the iniquities of his people. This king of thorns is the only hope that we have. Abimelech was an illegitimate king in a number of ways. This king of thorns has been given all authority in heaven and on earth. He is the ultimate, the true king of our lives. In her poem, A Fillet of Thorn, Anita Granis writes, "Tell me, how can I sing who have not tasted pain? Who, having grieved an hour, laugh and am glad again? It will take a winter of frost, aching and storm-filled years, before I am Lord of life, before I am King of tears." Stay with us. There's more about the Book of Judges in the next episode of Wide Margins.